From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. An American ideal from colonial through modern times has been the notion of the simple life, plain living and high thinking. Those are the subjects of a forthcoming book by one scholar who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. David Shy teaches history at Davidson College in Davidson, North Carolina. During his fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Professor Shy worked on a book entitled The Simple Life, Plain Living and High Thinking in American Culture.
Well, my specialty in history has been American cultural history and intellectual history. And during the 1970s, as we all experienced, the energy crisis and persistent inflation and the environmental movement and the ecological crisis, all of these combined, of course, to produce considerable concern and action, and some might say inaction, on the part of public spokesmen, statesmen, as well as various individual groups concerned with specific aspects of those problems. And I was particularly struck by the growing discussion about the need for simpler living habits in Western nations, and particularly the United States.
There was this great trend toward a kind of a nostalgia. Let's get back to simpler times.
Yes, nostalgia is very much implicit in the idea. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, it's not just wishful thinking, for there were and are many Americans who were practically living according to this ideal. And it was that particular aspect of the issue, that is the fact that this simple life has served both as an element of nostalgia or a social myth, and at the same time that it's been coupled with persistent practice, that is, individuals have made the myth reality. That combination struck me as a very significant cultural issue. And at the same time, there was this growing discussion and popularity of the phrase simple life. What struck me was that most of the people in the 1970s who were talking about it in the United States seemed unaware that there was a rich tradition of simple living in the American experience from the colonial period through the present. But as a subject that is primarily promoted by thinkers and statesmen and ministers and moralist, idealist, the simple life is a voluntary life. That is, voluntary simplicity is what I'm talking about. And for that reason, it is a lifestyle that is primarily the monopoly of those who have the freedom to choose their standard of living. This means, therefore, that voluntary simplicity does not apply to those social groups at the bottom of the ladder, who by no fault of their own are living in enforced simplicity.
Well, doesn't this mean that you're talking about a group of people who have the luxury of agency here?
That's right, the luxury of simplicity.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that a contradiction?
There are a lot of contradictions in the middle of this idea, and that's one of them. Mm-hmm. That is, simplicity is largely an option for those who, for one reason or another, have the initiative or the means to devote to plain living and high thinking.
You're talking, David, about things all the way from natural cereals. Natural, I have heard, is the most abused word in American advertising, all the way to things like the Whole Earth Catalog.
That's right. And of course, in the 1970s, this move to simplicity has acquired considerable commercial connotations, and businesses have been very quick to pick up on the popularity of it. But you're right, the term is used in many ways in contemporary American society to refer to activities as varied as the back to the land movement, mm-hmm. Organic gardening, yep. Natural foods that you mentioned, but also the anti-nuclear movement, the environmental protection movement. All of these manifestations do indeed relate to the concept that I'm talking about. Yet what I've tried to do in shaping my study in my book is to use a definition that's somewhat more broad and philosophical than these particular activities or manifestations. And what I've decided upon is that the simple life, for my purposes, represents a philosophy of living that self-consciously tries to subordinate the material aspect of life to the spiritual or the moral or the ideal. One of the themes of my study has been that the popularity of the simple life has tended to ebb and flow in American history according to historical circumstances. And it particularly is enhanced during periods of national crisis. So that, for example, during the Revolutionary era, during the Civil War, there were numerous spokesmen for simple living, for the need on the part of the public to engage in self-denial for the benefit of the higher cause, whether it be the war effort or, for example, during the Depression of the 1930s. Again, there was provoked by an external crisis, a renewed interest in simple living, whereby people theoretically would be more self-sufficient. After World War II and during the 1950s, it was at perhaps its lowest ebb, because, as you know, that period of post-war America was one of unparalleled prosperity, economic growth. It seemed that there was no need for simple living anymore. That is, abundance was widespread. It seemed to be permanent. President Kennedy talked about a rising tide lifts all boats, and Lyndon Johnson picked up on that theme by developing what he called his Great Society program, intended to abolish poverty everywhere, so that the need for simplicity or the ideal of simplicity seemed irrelevant in an age of abundance. But then suddenly, of course, in the mid-60s, everything exploded. That post-war consensus based on the high, wide, and handsome ideal of American economic growth suddenly shattered in the midst of the social turmoil created by resistance to the Vietnam War, as well as the civil rights movement and the student revolt on campuses.
Is there implicit in all of this a tone of apology? Are Americans really sort of looking either backward or forward in this desire for the simple life and saying, you know, we really have it too good? That material influence, they want it, they want to get away from it at the same time.
There is a sense of, one might call it guilt. Americans mm-hmm. have always been burdened by a curious idealism. That is, from the colonial beginnings, of course, many settlers, particularly the Puritans, for example, came to the New World explicitly to live out a spiritual objective, a very high ideal about what life should be. And yet at the same time, many colonists came to the New World for reasons much more mundane, a desire for land, for gold, in the case of some of the Jamestown settlers. So Americans, from the very start, have inherited these dual objectives, one a very high ideal, the other a very practical and mundane reality. So we've carried this special burden of a peculiar nation with a peculiar providential mission, and yet at the same time have developed into, of course, the most prosperous and abundant society the world knows. And it's this combination of very successful material growth with an ongoing sense of providential destiny and superior virtue mm-hmm. that has combined, I think, to make the simple life somewhat distinctive in the American experience.
How does all of this come to American shores?
Well, it comes in a very direct way on board the ships that brought John Winthrop and the Puritans to New England. They, of course, inherited the Christian concept of simple living as transmitted through the medieval theologian Thomas Aquinas, and then by later modified by the Reformation leader, John Calvin. And they brought to America what has since become known as the Puritan ethic. Unfortunately, that phrase is frequently misunderstood.
In other words, you're not going to condemn it.
I'm not going to condemn it. I'm going to, in fact, relate the original Puritan ethic in its most pristine form to this doctrine of the simple life that I'm talking about. That is, Winthrop and the Puritans arrived in New England with a clear understanding that work was necessary, that material rewards were justified for that work, and yet at the same time they emphasized, as Calvin did, that work and its rewards were always subordinate to the worship of God, that man must never come to love his work and its rewards in the same sense that he must love God and his fellow creatures. So materialism was never to be allowed to quench the thirst for worship and for piety that they believed necessary for the good life. Unfortunately, the New World environment offered so many entrepreneurial opportunities that within a few generations, the Puritan ethic had been transformed and secularized into a work ethic, losing much of its spiritual meaning and its spiritual limitations, so that work in and of itself became a Christian duty, and became a duty, became the good life. And the spiritual boundaries that had been defined by Christ and Aquinas and Calvin and John Winthrop, the first governor of Massachusetts Bay, were quickly eroded. Within a very few years after the first settlement, ministers and magistrates began to bemoan what they saw as a falling away from the original ideal of simplicity, and established a pattern thereafter of each generation more or less declaring that they had fallen away from the original vision of the founders, and that we were no longer as pure or as saintly as we should be. Then in the 18th century, during the Revolutionary era, Americans discovered another foundation, and that would be the foundation of classical philosophy and history. And this is where those two strands begin to come together, that is, the Puritan foundation or heritage and the classical heritage. What happens, interestingly enough, in the midst of the crisis with Great Britain in the 1760s and 1770s, is that American leaders, Jefferson, John Adams, Sam Adams, Benjamin Rush, Richard Henry Lee, are primarily steeped in classical learning. So they have a very strong and rich understanding of classical philosophy. And in relating their learning to contemporary problems, particularly the relationship of the colonies to the mother country, Britain, they more and more look to the classical Republic of Rome as their ideal of what a republic should be. And increasingly, they saw their association with England as corrupting their virtue, because England was undergoing a tremendous commercial and the beginnings of an industrial expansion in the middle of the 18th century. And they view their economic relationship with England, by which primarily England was trying to sell many of its quote-unquote luxury goods to Americans, as a corrupting influence. So in one sense, a very important sense, American revolutionary leaders saw the need to break away from that relationship in order to sustain what they considered to be American virtue, to cleanse themselves of a corrupt relationship, a relationship with a corrupt British empire, and to start anew as a republic of virtue in and of their own, in and of themselves, a republic of virtue in which this ideal of simple living would become paramount, would become the standard.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, Conversations with Scholars and Visitors at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to a conversation with David Shy, who teaches American history at Davidson College in North Carolina. Professor Shy recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. He's the author of a forthcoming book entitled The Simple Life: Plain Living and High Thinking in American Culture.
after the Revolution, when independence is achieved, and these founding fathers who had hoped that the mere act of independence would indeed set up a republic of virtue, they discovered, much to their dismay, that Americans were not any more virtuous than Englanders were. That in the aftermath of the Revolution, there was a tremendous speculative boom. There was a dramatic growth of imports of English luxuries. So nothing seemed to have changed. The Revolution itself had not created this classical republic of virtue that they had envisioned. And therefore, in the decade or so after the end of the Revolution, many of these founding fathers, looking around them and seeing how Americans were actually behaving themselves, decided that the republic of virtue may not work. And therefore, they came to the Constitutional Convention in 1787, determined now to forge institutional means to more or less enforce behavior. As one historian has said, the republic of virtue would now become a republic of laws.
But that was no reason to forsake this idealism.
That's right. What they finally fashioned on was a very tenuous synthesis. That is, they hoped that they could somehow promote commercial growth and manufacturing growth, but at the same time sustain a virtuous public, and a public that would still lead a simple life, or the middle way advocated by classical philosophers and Christian theologians, that somehow we could indeed have it both ways. That is, we could enjoy prosperity, but maintain our piety, maintain our virtue. Jefferson, for example, always talked about an equilibrium between the manufacturing sector and the agricultural sector, that cities and factories would not come to overwhelm American society. Of course, they eventually did come to dominate rather than simply counterbalance the agricultural side of life. So by unleashing the forces of capitalism and commercialism, these Republican moralists unwittingly, of course, supported events and circumstances that warred against the simplicity of manners that they so much desired. To illustrate what I mean by the simple life, it may be useful to use a statement by Emerson, in which he said that life is a selection, no more. And in essence, the simple life represents an ethic that requires a selection. It requires discrimination on the part of the individual to self-consciously decide how much or how little time to devote to his material needs, so as to assure that his higher needs always remain primary.
Well, tell me about some of the spokesmen. Tell me about some of the major figures in American culture that you point to as examples of the simple life.
At the ascetic extreme, or the self-denying extreme, of course, probably the foremost example that would come to mind to Americans would be Thoreau. I myself think that Thoreau's reputation is greatly distorted in the popular imagination. Most people don't understand that he was at Walden for only a little over 2 years, and that Walden Pond was only a little over a mile from the center of Concord, and that Thoreau's family frequently brought him food, and other visitors frequented his hut at Walden Pond. But nevertheless, Thoreau himself certainly lived a very austere life. He consciously set about trying to limit his desires and his needs so as to free himself to devote most of his time and energy to the pursuit of poetry and philosophy and sauntering and observation of nature.
A lot of people also fail to recognize the fact that this was for him his own experiment, and a kind of a blueprint. He didn't mean to, he wasn't trying to sell this as a bill of goods socially.
That's right. So many people assume that Thoreau was advocating this as the only way to the good life. And of course, he explicitly says in Wallen that he was not trying to provide a blueprint. He was simply describing his own experiment in simple living, and that if others saw merit in it, that was fine. But at the same time, he recognized that others could practice a simple life, a good life, in a very different way. For example, Emerson. Emerson, of course, was very much of an influence on Thoreau, and yet Emerson did not go off and live in the woods. It was Emerson, in fact, who provided the land at Walden Pond for Thoreau to build his hut on. Emerson enjoyed a legacy from his first wife that enabled him to devote most of his time to writing and discussion and lecturing, so that his simplicity was in large measure a stroke of luck or fortune. That is, he inherited some money that enabled him thereafter to devote his life to high thinking. Yet at the same time, even though he inherited money, he was very conscientious in the way he used his money. He was not extravagant in his expenditures. He frequently offered the warmth of his home and the food on his table to others in need. For example, Bronson Alcott and his family, and Thoreau himself was taken in as a handyman who earned his keep by working around the house. So Emerson lived a simple life, but it was a more comfortable simple life, enjoying a higher standard of living, of course, than Thoreau. And yet both of them still followed the same basic principle, and that was to focus one's energy and attention on the higher things mm-hmm. in life.
Now, I take it that Emerson would represent a midpoint on this spectrum.
Right. On the spectrum, I think Emerson would be somewhere in the middle.
Now, who would be at the other end here?
At the other end of the spectrum, that is, those who practice a simplicity that also carried with it a considerable amount of wealth, you might look at someone as wealthy as an Andrew Carnegie, perhaps the wealthiest man in America by the end of the 19th century. Carnegie nevertheless carried with him throughout his life and his business career a heavy burden of conscience that he too should not allow his wealth and his business activities to corrupt himself. So that in the 1880s, he wrote a very famous essay on wealth, in which he stressed that the man of wealth has a special obligation, an obligation to use his wealth for social purposes through philanthropy, and at the same time to live in a way, that is, the wealthy man must adopt a personal standard of living that is not extravagant, that is not ostentatious, that does not create envy or resentment on the part of those around him. And Carnegie stressed that those of his class, that is, the rich of the world, had to follow those two guidelines. First, they must use their wealth as stewards of wealth for others or for the benefit of society through philanthropic donations to various institutions or individuals. And secondly, in their personal lives, they must serve as an example of discriminating consumption as opposed to engaging in the colossal extravagance that was indeed practiced by so many of the new rich mm-hmm. in the Gilded Age.
It seems to me that this equation of plain living and high thinking might allow an individual to look the other way, to enjoy a material culture and to enjoy at the same time a certain number of pieties.
Well, the problem you raise is indeed a relevant one. Just as in the case of any philosophy of living, the simple life has been colored by hypocritical practices. John Woolman, for example, in the 18th century, as a Quaker spokesman, was very much upset that fellow Quakers in the colonies, who were supposed to live up to the ideals of Christian humanitarianism as well as plain living, were not only owners of slaves, but frequently engaging in the slave trade, allowing others to provide their standard of living for them through slave labor. And of course, this dilemma, or this hypocritical element that you mentioned, it was not just unique to the Americans by any means. Of course, the Greek philosophers, for the most part, enjoyed the convenience of slave labor that enabled them the leisure time to engage in their own high thinking. So yes, it can become a rationalization for the manipulation of others, or for inherited wealth, or for other practices. But just because there have been hypocritical practitioners, one must beware of throwing out the seed with the chaff. The ideal, I think, still remains viable and important, even though frequently its practitioners have not lived up to it. It's an ideology, or it's an ethic, I guess would be a more accurate term, that has tended to cut across political lines. It has tended to be a conserving movement in the sense that it wants to conserve values that have a rich tradition, conserve values in the face of modernity and all its changes. It's a fundamental movement in the sense that it is concerned with the basic question of how one should live. And for that reason, as I mentioned before, it is an inherently moral ethic, concerned with how one should act, not necessarily how we do act. Always striving to perfect one's virtues rather than simply accepting fatalistically the deficiencies of human nature or of a particular society.
It's difficult because it's voluntary.
Well, it's difficult because it's voluntary, but also difficult because in most cases you're going to be running up against the grain of larger society and its way of life and its temptations, its allurements. And for this reason, it's hard for an individual to sustain the principles embodied in the simple life when most of those around you are following a very different life. So it requires a certain amount of self-certitude, self-esteem, as well as courage of conviction in order to maintain the ideal in the face of larger society and its ways of life.
In other words, if it's good, you're going to find out about it, and if it's mean, you're going to expose it.
That's right.
You've been listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. My guest was Professor David Shy of Davidson College in North Carolina. Professor Shy is the author of a forthcoming book entitled The Simple Life, Plain Living and High Thinking in American Culture. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for a conversation about the simple life, plain living and high thinking in American culture. Professor David Shy of Davidson College recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a book about American notions of the simple life, practical and ideal conceptions of simplicity that evolved from the Puritan foundations of New England into the 1980s. To what degree have Americans lived the simple life? What forms does it take today? Listen for some answers and insights. A discussion of plain living and high thinking in American culture. This week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.